This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Hello, friends. Today we have Phil Murray, chair of the Otago Central Environmental Society, and Matthew Soule, the secretary of the Central Otago Environmental Society. We'll be talking about the environment, particularly water in Central Otago. Well, can you briefly tell us about Otago Central Environmental Society, why it was set up, and what's its mandate and purpose?
Well, we're a group of people from the community who speak for the environment, really, going to bat over environmental issues in Otago and just remind people of the environmental cost of some of the decisions we make in this current model of sustainable economic growth, which of course is an oxymoron. There are ways, of course, of maintaining an economy without environmental cost, but we're currently on a road where we seem to accept major cost to our environment for this economic growth model.
Okay, what are the main
Matt
issues?
Might be able to talk more about the background of the environmental society.
Yeah, we grew out of, I guess, when the council was Central Otago District Council was developing its district plan. And we were really advocating strongly for better landscape protection across Central Otago, because we could see this creep up the valley walls with lifestyle rocks and the like. So, and I mean, we're a group of people with giving voice to the environment, and we've got no vested interest. We're purely advocating and giving voice to the needs of the environment.
I would struggle that you've got no vested interests. I mean, you live there, and you probably have a couple of acres. Yeah. And are you mostly retired?
No, I'm still actively. I work as an archaeologist.
Okay, but you have interests, and they just might be different from some other people's interests.
Yeah, no, we do have
no economic interest.
Yeah, we do have a vested interest. We've all got a vested interest in our environment. I've worked in that area for a long time. I'm a landowner in the area, so I've got a big vested interest in the environment, I must say.
And I also have a water right, so which I use to water our vegetable and fruit crops and that. So, yeah, I certainly understand and appreciate the value of water in this semi-arid climate.
What are the main issues that are facing Central Otago right now?
Well, of course, water quality is the biggest one, which is around water volume, and that leads off into other issues around land use that affect water, both used water and affect water.
Okay, can you
landscape protection and biodiversity are other issues, and exotic weed invasion is a really big issue, which of course is one of the symptoms and costs of having grown our earlier economic model that has come home to roost in wilding pines, and there's a whole suite of exotic invasives there infecting our environment. So that's weed invasions are another big one. And of course, managing the impacts of tourism, on people's living environments is another one.
I think also there's a concern with sedimentation and off-land sedimentation and concerns over the actual soil health in terms of the way we're using the land and the soil.
Do you have any thoughts on the idea of an international airport near Wanaka?
Well, it's an absolutely absurd notion that flies in the face of all those things, that all those values that people come here to live, really. It flies in the face of all the things we know about climate change. It's not going to encourage the type of tourism that we've been talking about, getting tourists to stay longer, and getting fewer tourists that stay longer and spend more money and actually enjoy those things that people came here to enjoy to live. So there's nothing. Unless you've got a direct interest in some sort of mass tourism, there's nothing in the airport for the locals, really, and I think popular opinion would reflect that.
I think also our infrastructure is, we're all becoming more and more aware of, is overloaded, and the burden is going to fall on the community. The roading, the bridging, the Three Waters, they're all under strain, and adding all that extra tourism is only going to add to that. And that they're all visitors, not ratepayers. So, the burden's not shared.
Well, that's an interesting thought. I think, at some point we'll have to look at taxation. But what's the state of our water, both in quality and quantity, and how much can be taken from the rivers?
Well, the Manahirikia is our main river in central here. We're the driest district in the country, and the quality of the water is poor and declining, and has been very much in line with the change in land use in Manahirikia to become more intensive, particularly around pastoral farming, around dairy and dairy support.
Is there a difference in dairy farming and sheep farming?
Yeah. So what the change has been is that previously irrigation water supported traditional dryland farming operations and was used to supplement and support those, strategically support those dryland farming operations for growing winter feed. And those systems were fairly well adapted to dry seasons and didn't need a lot of a big, large area of irrigation to actually make them function quite efficiently. What we have had is a change over to farming systems that are totally dependent on irrigation and irrigate right through the summer. And if the irrigation stops, they fall over. And those are around dairy and dairy support, highly intensive systems. And they are very dependent on irrigation and are highly problematic in their discharges.
Now, what's
take a lot of water and have some serious discharges. So the consequences has been quite a serious decline and a continuing decline in our water quality.
What's been the pressure to go from raising sheep to dairy farming?
Well, dairy farming was simply more profitable. So land tends to be used for its most profitable use within the legal framework which it operates at. So you can't blame the individual dairy farmers for choosing the most profitable use. What we had was a highly enabling legal framework where water rights were granted to replace what were deemed permits under mining rights, and these rights were for a long time were granted hell for leather really to by under RMA permits with very little scientific understanding of the impact of those systems on the river. And conversion to dairy could be carried out as a right. So there was very little constraints. And there was no constraints on where intensive, the types of soils and where intensive agriculture could occur. So we've got highly intensive winter feed crops on porous alluvial soils right next to the river where it's absolutely impossible to keep those nutrients in the organic cycle. And of course they go straight into the aquifer or straight into the river, certainly in high rainfall levels.
Okay. What's the difference in the rules for mining rights and water and the normal rules you have for rivers in New Zealand?
Well, those mining rights were issued at a time, up to 100 years ago, issued at a time when
the gold rush.
There was no consideration of environmental effects. And I think something like four times the minimum flow were allocated under those mining permits. You could drain the river dry with those mining rights. And it was only in the advent of the RMA that put some requirements for transferring those to RMA permits and a consideration of the taking of that water on the environment. So, they came from an era when mining had no consideration for the environment. Now mining, of course, has got to consider the environment along with all other land uses.
Who has the legal responsibility for the care for the environment in Central Otago?
Well, it's shared between central government, regional government, and district councils. So there's a hierarchy there where central government issues national environmental standards, which we have the national environmental standards for fresh water, which currently set a hierarchy for considerations that the regional council are required to meet, and they are ecological function is the first priority. And then if that's met, you can take water for drinking, and then if that's met, you can take water, those other two are met, you can take water for irrigation. That's the current current standards, and the regional council is required to produce land and water plans which comply with those standards, and then district councils have responsibility for under those national environmental standards and regional council rules to plan for land use and urban growth. So there's a hierarchy here. So all three of them have a responsibility.
The over the last few years, the Otago Regional Council's had difficulty sometimes finding unity and agreement. They've had chair people who have resigned, and they've had other disputes. Can you talk about what are the disputes have been about water mostly, hasn't it, and regional plans. Is that the case?
So, sorry, can you just repeat that question, Liam Allen?
The Otago Regional Council has had disunity until very recently for a few years.
Sure.
And the disputes have been about water mainly, haven't they?
Sure.
Can you talk about that?
Why is that? Well, at its heart, there's a philosophical divide between those who support an economic model based on the need for continuous growth and accepting an environmental cost for that growth, and those who wish an economy to sustain an economy that doesn't compromise the environment. So there's two philosophical bodies there, In the past, the regional council has been dominated by rural councillors who, because they receive the greatest benefit from, for example, taking water out of the environment, out of rivers, and they share the cost of that between everyone, then they are inclined to accept a lower environmental standards. And a degraded environment because they meet the benefit of that. However, there's been a change in the representation and politics in the council where there are a slight majority of urban voters, and some of them are rural too, who are actually concerned about an economy that is dependent on degrading the environment to grow. So that's, we have this kind of standoff between these two philosophical approaches. And at the moment, the national government seem to support growing the economy at the cost of the environment, which in our view is pretty short-term thinking.
Okay, what's happened to the river so far and what's likely to happen if there aren't changes?
With what changes?
What's likely to happen to the river if the economy is the main and key factor?
I'll let you take that one, Matt.
Oh, sorry. What was the
What's the likely future of the river if the economy is the main factor in the decision?
Well, yeah, it's just continuing ecological degradation. I mean, basically, most rivers throughout New Zealand they abstract about 25% here in this, the Manuhirikia catchment. They're taking about 75% of the river.
That's quite a percentage.
The mean annual life flows of the river.
Has this been happening for a long time?
Oh, a very long time. I guess what's happened, and Phil might be able to help me here, people have deemed permits, and for a long time they were perhaps only taking a quarter of their deemed permit for water needs because they were operating, as Phil explained, you know, a dryland farming system with some winter feed. But now we've moved into fairly considerably more intensive land use, and the farming systems that operate now require water reliability up in the 95%. So they're now using much more of the their allocated water right or deemed permit, and that's at the expense of the ecology of the river.
Now,
and the communities noticed that change. I mean, you know, there's a, you know, it's much more difficult to swim in the river instead of, you know, where having a free running river and you could float between pools and swimming holes. Now you basically have the swimming hole, and you have issues with algal blooms and, you know, various other, you know, contamination, pollution issues with the water.
I suppose the contamination is a bigger issue than whether you could swim in it or not.
Well, what you have with the contamination, with reduced flows, you have much less dilution. So, yeah, things are concentrated more.
Yeah, so those dual factors are quite important. So what as Matt said it's, and it hasn't been well understood, is that although the amount of water allocated may not have, in fact, the amount of water that's been formally allocated is actually reduced. There's two things that have gone on there. One of them is that the rights have been fully utilized when they weren't before. And the other is the amount of discharge into the river has actually increased. So we've got more water coming out and a less of a dilution factor. And that ends up with signs saying you can't swim here in periods of low flow because of high E. coli and or algal blooms. And they are all symptoms of even though they are natural so-called natural phenomena, they happen far more frequently and far more seriously in under the present circumstances of the 3/4 of the mean annual low flow has been taken for irrigation.
I mean, some of the tributaries get dewatered. You know, there's no flow.
Okay, we'll play some music and then I'll come back to this. That was Craig Smith from 45 Degrees South. And we're talking with Phil Murray and Matthew Soule from the Central Otago Environmental Society. And you can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Well, what's happening now? I mean, with how the rules change in Central Otago and what's coming up?
Well, in the past, if you're referring to rules around water, there have been a fairly minimal level of rules around minimum flows and a highly accommodating rules for taking irrigation water to the point that 3/4 of the mean annual low flows have been are allowed to be taken for irrigation, which leaves the river in a fairly precarious state. So the current minimum flows we have is 0.9 of a cumec at OFA, and we have no minimum flow at the Alexander campground. The rules we have, and there's the Galloway irrigation outtake below OFA, the rules we have around the Galloway irrigation take is that they have to leave a flow of 300 millimetres by 150 millimetres deep. And that is, I'm not sure what that is in cumex, but it'll be less than 0.9 of a cumex. And you've got to consider that in the context that the calculated natural mean annual low flow is 4 cumex. So that's less, 0.9 is less than a quarter of the natural mean annual low flows. So okay. There's very little environmental, has been very little environmental protection.
Is this actually, are we talking about the problem or are we talking about a symptom? It seems, should the type of farming or industrialization, in this case farming, should that be taken into consideration in regional planning? I mean, some places are quite well suited to, most places in Central are quite reasonably well suited to sheep farming, but not so well suited to dairy.
Sure,
now,
sure.
Does the problem go back there? Should the government encourage, try ways of encouraging sheep farming and discouraging dairy farming?
Well, I think the approach is to let it sort itself out, is to deal with mean annual low flows in the river and maximum environmental discharge levels and let it sort itself out.
Well, actually, you're sorting human beings out in a way because we've encouraged people to take up dairy farming. Our society has, our government has, and Fonterra has, and the economic system has encouraged people to switch from sheep to dairy farming.
Sure.
And the people that took it up probably didn't really consider that the river flow would change or all the consequences. And now they're stuck, aren't they?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So that's why I'm talking about this in a way of being a symptom as well as a...
It's absolutely a symptom. Yeah. Yeah, it's a symptom of allowing the most profitable use to occur on the land without any consideration for accounting for the environmental cost of that.
Should that be one of the considerations when we talk about regional planning and so on, not just the amount of water you can take from the rivers, but the kind of industry or the kind of agriculture you encourage or discourage?
That's right, exactly.
You can do that by
simply putting in minimum flows and standards which would encourage certain uses and discourage others. Or you could cut to the chase and you can make things like dairy conversion a discretionary and controlled activity.
You want to talk about that?
Well, you know, they have advantages and disadvantages. The purist would say that you put in standards and allow the economic land uses to sort themselves out. The problem with that is that it relies very much on monitoring the environment to work out and enforcing those standards to ensure that the economics of the use that's been chosen are actually truly accounted for. And by the time you actually account for, you allow, say, dairy conversions to go on and for areas to be developed as dairy platforms right on alluvial flats right beside the river, then by the time you rely heavily on monitoring, and then you've got a very difficult enforcement project to carry out there when someone's made a big investment that is unsustainable.
Well, isn't that why you should actually bring into account the kind of agriculture that the land's used for? Wouldn't that be fairer in a way? Because probably the people, when they switched, not so much now, but when they originally switched to dairy, they didn't necessarily take into consideration the extra water that it would actually be using and the results, both.
Yeah, so there is a strong argument for actually predicting some of these problems and actually making, like a lot of district councils have, making dairy conversion a discretionary activity, and actually having some quite strong controls on the more vulnerable areas of a catchment, like alluvial flats, and making making, say, irrigation or winter feed crops a discretionary activity on those areas. So you actually, you know, regulate a bit of rational land use. But you know, when you stand back and look at Central Otago, you know, the suitability of dairy farming in Central Otago, and you look what it takes to make Central Otago suitable for dairying, you know, the driest area in the country, suitable for a use that requires extracting huge amounts of water from the river, and then you account for the economic cost of that, which requires quite a big infrastructure of water storage. Water storage is not cheap. Pumping that water all over pasture, and then you account for the environmental cost. There's actually no way that dairying is at all suitable for Central Otago. Full stop. Like, why would you choose Central Otago for that use? And you tend to choose land use options that take advantage of Central Otago's unique climatic characteristics, which is a lot of sunshine. And you would tend to choose things like horticultural crops, like stone fruit crops and whatever, that utilize the strong sunlight, and things like grapes that don't require a huge amount of water and are quite intensive and give you a good bang for your buck. But you certainly wouldn't choose a use that was far better suited to places that where it rains a lot. So to change the natural characteristics of our climate to make it suitable for dairy is extremely costly in both environmental and economic terms.
What's the story now? What's the regional council doing, and what are they putting forward? I know you don't have precise detailed information, but what's the general?
Well, what's come out in the over the last thanks largely to the previous government's National Environmental Standards on fresh water, where they put ecological function as the top consideration. Then finally, there's been a lot of science gathered on the actual requirements or the actual condition of the river and the requirements of the river for ecological function. And not surprisingly, they concluded that the river needs a lot closer to its natural flow, 4 cumex, than 0.9 of a cumex. Finally, they're actually adding up some of these ecological costs of what's been created, and the public of Otago has spoken to the regional council that they value their natural environment, that their natural environment is extremely important to them, that it's the essence of why people live in Central Otago. So Central Otago people are very concerned about the quality of the environment. That's why they live here. So the regional council has responded to that by proposing what COES thinks is a fairly minimal regime to addressing the ecological function and the quality of the water in the Minnehirakia by proposing a regime of increasing the minimum flows over time up to a level where its ecological function is more likely to be assured. And we think there's some huge risks in the time it's going to take to do that. But at least it's getting on the road. So the people have spoken of Otago, and the regional council has responded, except they've run into a philosophical dogma from central government that is hell-bent on growing the economy come what may at our environmental costs. And central Otago people are not happy about that.
Well, Otago, most, apparently Federated Farmers is quite happy about it because they don't want the regional council to make decisions until the national government's put forward their plans.
Well, the Federated Farmers, of course, won't be happy about that because they are expecting that the national environmental standards for fresh water will lower the environmental standards. So we've got a conflict between the central government's agenda of growing the economy, come what may, which benefits the farmers in central Otago because they get all the benefit out of sucking water out of the river, whereas the wider Otago community meet all the costs. The cost is shared between everyone. So you've got a kind of reverse, we've got a tragedy of the commons going on here. It's a pretty absurd standoff that we're getting threatened by having accepting lower environmental standards by compulsion.
The way I understand it, during the election, the government was talking when it came to Three Waters and other schemes, the believing in local autonomy and listening to the local people.
Yeah.
Is that what's happening now?
as it turned out, that statement was made on the proviso that the local community wanted what the national government wants. But as reality turns out, the Otago populace realised that their economy is very aligned with the state of our environment, because our economy relies on people wanting to come here to live because it's a great environment to live in. And it's a great environment to live in because it's got a great natural environment. People, when they have a weekend, they've got a day off, they can go out, go and swim in a river, go kayaking in a river, go mountain biking, and they can enjoy the environment. That's why people come here. And a lot of our economy is based on people who come here because it's a nice place to live, and they bring with them jobs which they can do online and whatever. And that forms a big part of the economy. And also tourism. People love to come and play in a place that's a nice place to live. So tourism very much relies on our environment. So our economy relies, our broader economy relies very much on our environment. One sector of our economy, the farming, can benefit from taking vast amounts of water out of our rivers and putting our environment at risk. But they get all the benefit, okay. And the disbenefit, the downside, is spread between all of us.
As a taxpayer, would you be willing to pay more taxes to make it more appropriate for dry land farming and other forms of agriculture?
I think most of us are happy to pay our taxes, provided we can see that those taxes are working for us.
Well, you don't find out if it's working for you unless you get a government that you respect and also see what's happening. And if also you have to ask yourself, are the taxes fair for everybody? But it seems to me that if you want a balanced ecology. You probably need a balanced economy.
You absolutely do.
And
you,
that
yeah, you
that
you
doesn't happen automatically.
What we have is a is an economy at the moment that benefits one narrow sector of society, and what's happening is that we have growth in the economy which benefits just a small proportion, and we have a we're growing that economy by increasing the population, so we have we are sharing our actually per head wealth, our per head productivity is actually going down. And then when you add to that the fact that the natural capital has been degraded at, as a consequence of and the way we are growing the economy, and then we share that natural capital between more people, we're actually getting poorer.
Do you think the
we're getting poorer?
The government will respect the decisions of the Otago Regional Council.
Directly, directly, it will
respect the decisions.
Will establish the national environmental standards for fresh water, and what they're indicating is that those standards will be lower. Now, in the past, national environmental standards have been set as a bottom line. It's going to be a first in the realms of environmental management that environmental standards are going to be set, and there's a threat of compulsion that if you don't change your standards to come down to those new lower standards, we'll replace you with commissioners. Now that will be the first in the realms of environmental management, I think. It happened as a consequence in Canterbury a few years ago, and we have the clear consequences of it with degraded lakes and rivers in Canterbury.
Well, what's the best way to prevent that? You can't call for another election.
No. Well, the best way to prevent it is actually for this government to realise the strong link between our environment and our economy. Our economy is our environment in New Zealand, and in enlightened management and long term management of our economy would be to align our economy more rationally with our environment.
Okay. In the short term, how do you get the government to accept that or to modify their position? Say that you have a water plan that to limits to some extent the damage to the rivers. How do you actually signal the government that it might be for their benefit to respect the autonomy and local feelings?
Yeah. Well, I think that this government needs to actually listen to the people. And I think the regional council are responding to the people in its current land and water plan. To all the people, not to just one sector of society. Whereas I think central government is banking on maintaining popularity simply by growing the economy, which actually won't benefit the wider populace, and that's been expressed through regional politics. So I think it's a very short-sighted political approach, let alone an economic approach. It'll come back and bite this council. Come back and bite this government.
Well, it's also ignoring a lot of the natural science that's been done and the monitoring that's showing, you know, that, that there is a cost to the environment with incessant development.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How do you make this a political cost?
You make it a political cost by helping people understand, join the dots between the quality of their lives, which is dependent very much on the environment, and the policies of the government. And this is what COES will be doing. We'll be bringing to light the environmental costs of the current government's model of growing the economy. We can't simply just grow the economy at the cost of the environment. We have to move to an economy that doesn't exist at the cost of the environment. And there'll be other ways that, quite apart from popular opinion and the effect of this this approach on the environment, and they will be through our markets for things like our dairy products. And we've just had a visit from Nestle that I'm sure remind Fonterra and dairy farmers that they don't want to borrow their product if it's going to be associated with degrading our environment. So I'd say Fonterra and Beef and Lamb will be very nervous about word getting out in the international arena about the environmental cost of producing products the way we are, unless we're very conscientious about how we produce those and the effect on the environment.
Does this move over to having also this same consciousness about climate change?
Well, climate change is even a more difficult one to join the dots with, in that people, well, governments in particular, are pretty good at dealing with the immediate benefits and pushing the costs off down the track. And I guess us humans are all pretty good at enjoying the benefits in the short term and pushing the costs off to future generations. Well, climate change is one of those. And the costs are immediately affecting us, but we seem to be pretty good at avoiding joining the dots between our lifestyles and our economy and who we vote for and the consequences of that and climate change. So climate change is going to be a difficult one because it requires a major change of behaviour, transition from fossil fuels to more less carbon associated forms of energy, but that's got to start now. And a responsible government has got to show leadership in this, and this current one is not looking inclined to do that.
Yeah, well, the debt's just growing year by year, and you know, the longer we put it off, the harder it is.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on board. And we've got about 2 minutes, so what are your hopes for the future in 2 minutes?
Well, I hope that that people stand up for their environment, recognize the links between the economy and the environment. I hope that the regional council and the regional councillors show courage in their leadership, which they've shown so far, that's been really impressive, that they stand up and support the popular opinion being shown by the public, that they value their environment and they get out there and do their duty in protecting the environment for Central Otago.
Okay, thanks a lot for coming on board and expressing the concerns of the Central Otago Environmental Society for our natural environment.
Okay, thanks, Marvin. Good talking to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.